case this morning is the United States against Zavala. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May I please the court? Good morning. I'm Philip D. Cave. I represent Petty Officer Zavala today. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Petty Officer Zavala's trial was unfair. The prosecution in the case took deliberate advantage of a judicial ruling by a military judge, and then, with the further assistance of the judge in the trial, continued to take advantage. And that's what the NMCCA said, and I think agrees with. Their language was, the prosecution with the military judge's assistance gained an unfair advantage over the appellant. And that relates to the issue of the complaining witness's integrity and credibility in this case, which I would argue in this case and in any case of this nature, the complaining witness's credibility, integrity, truthfulness is in fact a central critical part of the case that any defense must address.
That may be true, but did not the motion deal with such things as the fact that the victim was flirty? And why is that not classic 412 evidence?
And Your Honor, the military judge correctly, and as an MCCA, correctly ruled, ultimately that particular type of evidence was not admissible and therefore it was not relevant.
So what specifically were you or was the appellant prevented from introducing at trial that you think he was deprived of producing?
The complaining witness had made a prior allegation of rape. Now, various people who've looked at that allegation can take different perspectives, from she made a false allegation to she made an allegation she wasn't sure, she made an allegation she withdrew it. At the point in time that the case began and the prosecution first introduced evidence, none of that evidence had been ruled admissible by the military judge. And that was the ruling of his 412 motion. And I think any responsible counsel would respect that ruling. And that's what happened here. However, circumstances changed, Your Honor, when the prosecution deliberately, in our mind, interjected the very thing that they had worked so hard to exclude. And that was the issue of, was there a prior allegation of rape, false or otherwise? And they deliberately had.
Now, when the prosecution, in your view, opened the door, what specifically did the defense indicate they wished to ask or bring in at that point that was distinct and more specific than the 412 motion?
The information that.
Citing to particular pages in the record.
I'll have to get you those pages, Your Honor. But it is unclear the specifics of what aspects of the allegation itself that could be gone into. And certainly, and as NMCCA themselves later said, there are aspects not just of her making the allegation, but her statement to NCIS and her own statement during trial itself, which could have been the subject of cross-examination as to whether or not that was truthful or whether it's an exaggeration or something, and that could have been a significant step in her credibility. And, Your Honor, one would expect the government felt they needed this. In other words, they needed to bolster, and I think that's reasonable for the prosecution, in a case of this nature, it's not unusual and perhaps not unnecessary for the prosecution to do what they can to bolster the complaining witnesses' credibility.
Are you saying they're trying to inoculate her?
Yes.
Okay.
Appellant thinks that they were doing two things. One is, in a sense, to say, this happened to me before, you've got to find him guilty now. because of me. And there is a potential sympathy factor that comes from that. On the merits, which I would argue, the appellant would argue, they then took further advantage of during the sentencing portion of the trial. And at that point in the trial where the military judge did not want appellant to explore the impacts or the impacts on the complaining witness, discreet as to what the members have found as to Petty Officer Zavala and what may or may not have happened in the prior incident in Virginia Beach, Your Honor.
And you're going to, on rebuttal, point to the specific pages in the record where that specific argument was raised with the military judge as opposed to the general 412 motion.
We'll get you that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Counsel, with respect to the 412 motion, is it the defense position that the evidence of the prior allegation of rape was correctly ruled to be inadmissible, but that the later action by the prosecution opened the door? Or is it the defense position that the evidence was admissible, but it doesn't matter how the judge ruled on it because the opening of the door creates a different situation? I'm trying to figure out where your position is on this.
I think your second point is the appropriate point here. I don't think the appellant doesn't think it matters what the judge ruled in the beginning as to the admissibility or non-admissibility. But once the prosecution opens the door, that changes the analysis. Or at least that changes the analysis. And the judge could have allowed some limited questioning about the prior incident and about the NCIS that she made to NCIS to continue to show that she would be a witness or a person who will say or do things which she feels she needs to say for her own sake. Whatever she said in the initial complaint, she wanted to get out of trouble with the police and her parents. She lied to get into the Navy. She lied to get a security clearance. And
let's focus on those things which were excluded as opposed to those things that were admitted.
Well, I understand, but I think that's relevant, Your Honor, because in their closing argument, the government makes much of that distinction because they talk about the defense flailing around, attacking the witness as to their credibility, and I think that adds to the importance of the error that the military judge.
I understand, counsel, but I would request that in addressing these matters, you distinguish between the two so that we're clear as to which items were excluded, and therefore you're complaining about that, versus those things that were admitted, and you're using those to bolster the argument.
Sure. The circumstances of the prior event would essentially be that she had made a complaint, while under the influence of alcohol and drugs, that the complaint was false.
Why was it false?
That's, as an advocate, that's my interpretation of the facts, Your Honor, but I agree that others who have looked at it have said that maybe this was when she later when it was explained to her by the Virginia Beach police what the suspect had said, she at that point said it could have happened, maybe it happened that way. So, yes, there is a difference, an interpretation there, Your Honor. And I apologize. I've gotten slightly off track here. And I apologize to you. I didn't mean it that way.
You can.
You're right. Climb out of the hole.
Right.
I don't feel like you're in a hole, so just
right.
Go ahead.
You're cleared up to be. Take your time, reset, and
right.
Begin where you think you should be.
Well, I try to be conscious of those things, Your Honor. That's my practice.
With no offense.
Thank you, Your Honor. As NMCCA, in their opinion, more discreetly, more deliberately pointed out, certainly the majority opinion, I understand Judge Beal disagreed somewhat, but on this issue of was she or was she not truthful with NCIS, because when she told the NCIS, it appears she was clear as to there was a rape and nothing happened. And then, of course, her testimony, which appears to argue that not only was there a rape, but nothing was done about it. And that's partly where the argument, Your Honor, the issue of are they bolstering, but also are they trying to get some sympathy, or are they trying to use this to encourage the members to say, my goodness, this has happened to you.
Okay. Assuming, arguendo, that the government opened the door.
Sure.
Where's the prejudice? Given the state of the other evidence, given particularly the testimony of the friend, or whatever you want to call him, that entirely undercuts the appellant's version of events.
Yeah, you're right, Your Honor, and I would imagine that's why we're here, because that's the best argument in this case, and that's the argument for the government, is, counsel, you've got bad facts, sit down and shut up.
Well, I'm not telling you to shut up. I'm asking you where the prejudice is.
I know, but that's the prejudice is that the trial counsel was allowed to argue that appellant was flailing around using essentially minor discrepancies, minor lies, if you will, about her enlistment, about her SF-86, while all the time they know. During that argument, the government and the judge knew that there was arguably a bigger lie that the members had not seen or heard. And in this kind of case, Your Honor, that's the prejudice in terms of depriving an accused of attacking in the best fashion possible the credibility of, in fact, the central witness. And I would argue, Your Honor, this was the central witness. Now, I understand that part of the harmless error analysis is that you look at the case as a whole, you look at all of the facts, and you look to see whether or not facts or other facts or circumstances corroborate what did or didn't happen. But let me make this point or argument to you, if I may, Your Honor. Nobody knows what happened when Petty Officer Savala and Petty Officer Townsell left the complaining witness's pod after that first visit. Because it appears that they were in the pod together. There's a disagreement between Petty Officer Savala when he testified and Petty Officer Townsell as to what was said or what happened in the pod. But there is agreement that they both left the pod. And after that, Petty Officer Townsell did not see Petty Officer Savala again until the next day. Whereas Petty Officer Savala says he went back, he cleaned up, and went back. So in other words, there is a break. It's not clear from the record whether this was a few minutes break. In other words, Townsell and Savala leave and they go to their rooms. A few minutes passes and Savala goes back, or a much longer break. But there is a break. So in reality, the only two people who knew what happened in that room at the time of the alleged rape would have been Petty Officer Savala and the complaining witness.
So do we take into account the appellant's version of the events to determine whether the appellant has put forth a version which would be persuasive to the members in light of the had the information come in that was otherwise excluded?
I don't think you can avoid that.
Okay, so what's his version of the events? What is the essence of what the defense version is of what happened?
His version of events is that after they had left, he cleaned up and he went back to the room. That he entered the room, that there was a period of time when he and the complaining witness engaged in conversation. They had discussions and ultimately they got to the point where they were having sex. And there is a point in time when Petty Officer Savala appears to say that he heard her say no or he thought her said no and he stopped and left. That's his version of events that happened.
So his version of the events, and what time of the morning did he come to her room?
Your Honor, that would have had to have been sometime after 06, because as you recollect...
0600. And did he have any prior conversation with her or any indication from her that she would be interested in seeing him at any time, and in particular that she'd be interested in seeing him at 0600 hours for an assignation as he described?
Yes, Your Honor. The answer is, according to counsel, no.
What about according to Savala?
According to Petty Officer Savala, he says that when they were first at the room, there was a brief...
I'm not talking about when he was first at the room. What invitation or indication did he have that he would be welcome at her room at 6 o'clock in the morning?
Prior to them arriving there, none.
So why is his story at all one that would be credible to a fact finder that he somehow... decided with no invitation, no flirtation, nothing that would indicate an interest on her part, that it was reasonable for him to just show up at her pod at 6 o'clock in the morning and engage in a discussion about that would lead to sexual relations?
Because they could have concluded, based on all of the evidence, that taking into account Townsend's prior interaction with her and her willingness to receive his room, I agree, a different person.
Is there any information in the record that Townsend communicated to the appellant that this was a possibility?
I would argue there is, Your Honor, because if the, in particular during the walk back from, I think it's the gate, or where they left the car, I'm not sure, to the park, there was discussion about getting together, hooking up with that girl you had met or talked to last week. And so I think there is arguably evidence in there which would support, in Petty Officer Savala's mind, the possibility, and excuse me for the vernacular, that he might get lucky that night. And that's what I think... with these sailors, that's the a reasonable construction that could be put on the events and the knowledge of the individuals at the time. I've got the red light. I'm sorry.
That's fine. You have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court. Assuming without conceding that the military judge erred in preventing appellant from cross-examining Seaman Arm when the door was open, the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt under Van Artsen for three reasons.
Is HBRD the proper standard?
Your Honor, typically the lower court should begin by evaluating whether or not...
Is this constitutional error?
No, Your Honor. This is.
Then why is HBRD the appropriate standard?
Well, Your Honor, the lower court treated it as such, and this court does not have to determine the exact legal nature of the error if this court can find that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, obviously, if it's HBRD, it's also not plain error, so go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, under the three, looking at the three parts of, three points under Van Artsel, one, Seaman Arm didn't lie during the Virginia incident. Two, Seaman Townsell directly contradicts appellant's testimony. And three, the strength of the government's case overcomes that one statement. If we look at Van Artsel...
Overcome that one statement. What statement is that?
The one statement that she explained that it happened, that Seaman Arm explained that it happened to her before and was resolved.
Oh, thank you.
Counsel, do we know... as a matter of uncontroverted fact that she didn't lie, or is that a matter for the fact finder to have determined if it was presented whether the information at the prior incident constituted a lie or whether it constituted a misimpression on her part?
Your Honor, here all we know is that she filed a complaint. At that she filed a complaint. And the case law says, under McElhaney and Velez, that the mere filing of a complaint is not probative of truthfulness or untruthfulness. And that's what we have here.
So wouldn't it be up to the members to decide how they would perceive it?
No, Your Honor, because first it has to be relevant, and here it's not even even relevant to her truthfulness. Here, she in the Virginia incident, she stated that she didn't know when confronted with what the alleged suspect said.
I thought we were in a situation where the government was arguing that we would pursue this as to whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And if the evidence should have come in, then why wouldn't it be up to the members to decide whether or not it constituted a lie on her part for purposes of determining how to review that evidence? In other words, if the government opened the door by saying this happened to her before,
yes,
and the defense wanted to take the position that it didn't happen to her before, that she lied about it, why wouldn't it be up to the members to decide whether the evidence of the prior incident constituted a lie or constituted a misapprehension, or the evidence didn't have any meaning at all? Why isn't it that their determination as opposed to our determination now here in this setting?
Your Honor, I think the best answer I have, Your Honor, is that that was the defense's theory, that they wanted to show that she lied in that previous incident. But the facts do not support it. No matter what reading you give, there is nothing in those Virginia reports to show that she lied.
Is your argument that the judge decides whether to admit it based on what facts are before the court rather than the theory of the defense? Is that what you're arguing?
Well, as far as going through the test, under the test they were looking at MRE 412, and the first part they were looking at was relevance. And here the military judge determined that it wasn't relevant, looking to McElhaney, and that it was merely a filing.
Wasn't that when he was ruling on the 412 motion? That wasn't later after the government opened the door by asking the question that they did, was it?
Well, yes, Your Honor, that's what happened in the motion limiting. And as far as opening the door, again, essentially the defense rearticulated that they wanted it in for the same purpose, that they wanted to explore that.
But having opened the door, doesn't that change the fact of whether it's relevant or not? I mean, assuming that the military judge was correct, that under 412 the evidence was not admissible and it wasn't relevant, et cetera, didn't the government make it relevant by having her testify the way that she did?
No, Your Honor. The way it came up was that it was only an explanation as to why from unrestricted to restricted. But Your Honor, assuming that it was relevant, assuming that it was there, it was still harmless under Van Artsen. I mean, looking at the rest of the test, under the rest of the Van Artsen test, we have Seaman Townsend's testimony that directly contradicts the appellant's testimony.
But you don't disagree that the only people that were actually in the room when the sexual intercourse took place, whether it was consensual, not consensual, or whether it was not consensual, but he reasonably believed it was consensual, were the accused and the victim.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So anything that anyone saw before that, what does that have to do with the relevant time period?
Well, Your Honor, it's looking at appellant's testimony, and he's saying that it started with him knocking on the door, having a 5-minute conversation with the victim, and her inviting him back later.
And so the members could believe him or not believe him, right?
Yes.
And then she testified, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And they could believe her or not believe her.
Yes, ma'am.
And so you don't think that evidence that would tend to make her credibility in question is relevant and important under Van Artsen?
No, Your Honor, because...
Because why?
Well, Your Honor, we have just that one statement. At the court-martial, we had 10 witnesses over 3 days with about...
Doesn't that go to weight rather than reliability? You're arguing weight. You're saying you got a lot here and not much there. That's weight.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, that is one of the factors we're looking at, the overall case, the strength of the government's case.
But the fact that the strength of the government's overall case is strong with respect to supporting the government's theory of the case, how does that change the analysis with respect to something that would affect the strength of the defense's case? the defense's theory of the case, which is that it happened this way, or he reasonably believed it happened this way, and she's lying when she says that it happened this way, when the only people that were there during the relevant time period were the two of them.
Yes, sir. Well, we have the extent of the cross-examination of the victim.
On this point with respect to her credibility.
With her credibility? Well, yes, Your Honor.
When the government knew, as the panel's counsel mentioned, that there was a larger issue with respect to her credibility, that they knew the military judge wasn't going to let them examine.
Well, Your Honor, they were allowed to go into whether or not she was truthful. They cross-examined her about supposed fraudulent enlistment, about how she didn't explain how there was a previous alcohol incident, about how she lied on overseas paperwork. So they were able to go into her character for truthfulness and attack her credibility with that extent of cross-examination.
Is that why you say that this isn't constitutional error?
No, Your Honor, because initially, in the motion in limine, the military judge determined that this particular evidence didn't fall within the constitutional exception, and the lower court agreed with that. And
this
once
didn't
the door
this
was
didn't fall within the constitutional exception to 412, the motion
right.
in limine. Okay, but now we've all, I think, moved back past the motion in limine to a different point in time.
Yes, Your Honor.
When she made certain statements during her testimony. Right, and I think that you conceded that changes the analysis somewhat.
Of Van Artsel, yes, Your Honor. That was assuming we get there.
And so, at that point in time, is it or is it not constitutional error? And if it's not, are you saying it's not because they were allowed to otherwise cross-examine her with respect to her truthfulness about her enlistment or the whatever else?
Your Honor, the government has looked for case law to determine whether or not the character has changed from from non-constitutional error to constitutional error just by opening the door. The government has not been able to find any case law to support
that. It's not the opening the door. The question is whether it's constitutional error is whether they were prohibited from cross-examining someone, effectively prohibited from cross-examining them on an issue that rises to the level of a constitutional impediment.
And
I mean, that's the test, not whether it was opening the door or not opening the door. I mean, once the door is opened, the question then is how much cross-examination was prohibited, and it was it constitutional error or not? So I'm asking you, was it constitutional error or not, and if not, why not?
No, Your Honor, it was not constitutional error.
Because?
It was not constitutional error because it didn't limit the defense's ability to cross-examine her on her credibility for truthfulness. What the defense was trying to do was say that she lied in the Virginia incident, she's lying here. That's what they were trying to do. In the veil of she lied there, and we wanted to cross-examine her on her credibility for truthfulness. Now, again, as far as corroborating evidence, Seaman Townsend contradicts the appellants, and then also fills in the gap for the victim who had no memory from the time she left the club to the time she woke up being raped. We also have, as I mentioned before, the extent of cross-examination, as well as the strength of the government's case. In the strength of the government's case, that one line is outweighed by the government's case. We had 10 witnesses over 3 days, about 400 pages of a record. The members weren't thinking about that one line. They were thinking about Seaman's arms testimony, her intoxication. They were thinking about how the door was broke and it wouldn't lock. They were thinking about how she had never met him, never met the appellant before. And the members were also able to take into account appellant's testimony and how they took that into account and discounted it. Based on all those factors, this error, if there was error, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt under Van Artsel.
Counsel, I'd like you to take a look at page 94 of the, 25 of the joint appendix, 94 of the record. And isn't the judge there saying
The reason I don't want to get into this issue in 2006, because I'm going to have to determine who's lying or not, whether she's lying or not.
Yes, sir.
And he describes that as a collateral issue. So if there was error, not necessarily at the 412 point, but at the point of opening the door, isn't that exactly what the members would then have had to decide, whether she was lying or not back in 2006 for purposes of assessing her credibility on the more recent allegation? And whether that explained, whether that was, then the defense could use that to rebut the government's inference that she was telling the truth in the past and now she's suffering for it?
That's what the members would have had to do, Your Honor, because it would have been a trial within a trial at that point.
Right, and so if the judge erred, if we're talking about harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, if the judge erred in preventing the members from hearing that, why isn't that prejudicial in this case? Why wasn't it prejudicial for the members to lose the ability to decide whether she was lying or not in 2006 for purposes of assessing whether she was suffering in 2000 in a later date when she had a delayed reporting?
Because the facts don't support, if the members were able to look at the evidence, the evidence doesn't support that she lied. At best, it supports that she didn't know, and when confronted, she said, yes, it could have happened that way.
Did the judge make that ruling in this case, or did the judge make the ruling that it was a matter that he would have to decide who was lying or not, and because he viewed it as collateral, he wasn't going to decide that?
No, the judge didn't make that determination, but he did say that Matt Mahaney was on point in saying that he would have had to, basically relying on the fact that it was just a complaint that was filed, and it's not probative of truthfulness or untruthfulness.
If the judge was correct on that in his 412 ruling, and he's incorrect on that in his ruling with respect to opening the door, then where does that get the government? As on the issue of who has to decide whether there's a lie or not.
Again, Your Honor, it's up to the military judge. Are we assuming the door's open?
Assuming the door's open, assuming the judge erred in not letting it in.
Then at that point, Your Honor, we can look at Van Arsdorp and determine that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I'll address the sentencing. The government, in here, in the lower court, as far as sentencing, the lower court determined that the military judge erred by limiting the cross-examination into the Virginia incident. At that point, the military judge was correct. He did not err by limiting that cross-examination. Here, the trial counsel focused all the questions on what happened as a result of this incident and never mentioned the Virginia incident. Because of that, there was no error there was no error in as far as sentencing goes. I'll conclude, again, just to focus on the main portion, any error that the military judge did limiting cross-examination when the door was open was harmless beyond reasonable doubt under Van Arsdorp, because in Virginia, in that Virginia incident, Seaman Arm didn't lie. Seaman Townsend's testimony directly contradicts the appellant's, and the overall strength of the government's case outweighs that one statement.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honor, thank you.
What is it? Can you decipher that? If the military judge, by not letting it in when the door was opened,
right.
I'm still trying to figure out what it is.
And let me answer that question and the one you answered me before.
And tell me what it is at trial, was at trial, and tell me what it is now.
Let me answer that.
The same.
If I can, let me try to answer that plus the one that you asked me.
It's the same question.
That's okay, and that's what I'm figuring out. And you're absolutely right, Your Honor. It is. it is it.
And you can only use four words in responding.
Sure.
It is the and and.
And you can't use any that have two letters in them.
Your Honor, you are pointing out something that I'd like to talk to, if I may, in a moment, Judge Ryan and Judge Stuckey about, is at trial, you say and do things. And it is clear from the record that you are reading today that it's unclear what was going on. And I would agree with
you. You're not here to testify. Please cite to the record, which is what we're reviewing.
Right. The pages you have on pages 209, the appellant agrees with you that it is not clear when...
What it is.
Exactly. Yes. The appellant's counsel during the what could be considered a request to reconsider, it was not phrased that way, a request to reconsider his earlier 412 ruling was not clear. That's correct, Your Honor. I agree that that's what the record shows. I would argue to the trial participants, it likely could have been clear. I'm not saying it was.
Counsel, could you identify for us what page in the record you're referring to and what page of the joint appendix?
209 of the volume 2 is what we've been referring to, Your Honor. I think that's where Judge Baker is focusing. Is
page 209 of the joint appendix?
209, Your Honor, yes.
Excuse me. The record.
I gave you the record trial. I apologize.
Record 207 and 209.
Pages 33 and 34 of what I have is volume 2.
Thank you.
I apologize, Your Honor. Let me see if I can bring that thread to what I perceive partly, actually all of you, but specifically Judge Ryan, Judge Stuckey. None of the people who are now looking at this cold record were present at trial. The members were. That's the critical distinction when you're looking here. And Justice Marshall in his dissent...
Hang on. The members are only going to have before them whatever it is.
Yes.
Right? So you still have to define what it is, because you can't say, well, members would have understood it, because you still have to say what it is. You can't just say they would have had it before them, therefore I win. We still don't know what it is. Was it the fact that she was flirty? Was it the fact that, in your view, there was a false allegation of rape? But that's not a fact or a piece of evidence. What is it? Your turn.
No, I understand. It's difficult to answer that question.
Well, why don't you try taking a look at the first paragraph at the top of page 34 of the joint appendix and tell us what you think that means.
Counsel is saying we are now entitled to challenge that and to challenge the credibility of that reason by exploring the circumstances, all of the circumstances, of the prior false allegation.
So that means the fact that she was flirty, that she's a drunk who likes to have sex with strangers, all that stuff that you put in the motion?
No. No, Your Honor. There is a difference between...
What was the question that defense wished to ask that the military judge deprived defense of asking that would have been permissible to ask?
During the motion session, there was a proffer that, did you lie to the police about this incident, etc.? And she would give a yes or no answer. And I think at one point, counsel said that they may or may not be stuck with that answer.
I had thought that in the earlier motion that the theory was that she had lied during the Virginia Beach incident in order to get out of trouble, and that with respect to her parents and the police, and in this instance she was also lying because she had a fiancé.
Yes, Your Honor. I have the orange. I'm sorry. I'm not very light. Yes, motive is always critical in this kind of case. And the fiancé not wanting to tell a fiancé that she'd had casual sex was the motive to lie. And yes, that was connection. In other words, she's the kind, and I very like me.
I could answer, finish answering the question.
May I answer?
Do you have, yes, please.
Oh, so that was making the connection that she is the type of person, based on the Virginia Beach incident and the other lies, who would willingly lie for her own benefit to get herself out of trouble, in this case, trouble with the fiancé, and that's the, and that's, you know, how she testified, her demeanor, all those kind of things, is what also goes into this and what you did not see. Thank you, Ron.
You may briefly conclude.
Oh, I'm finished. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you. We thank both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:20 a.m.
Court stands in recess for 5 minutes.